Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 3rd, 2006. Our session today is titled Doers of Justice in Israel and Palestine. Our presenter is Jonathan Frericks, session number FRJ 2006-4. Let's listen in.
The fourth session in a series called Risking Love in the Holy Land, from Facts to Faith. And my name is Jonathan Frericks. I work for the World Council of Churches in Geneva, and I work on advocacy about the Middle East and some other things. To give those of you who are new and a little refresher course to those of you who are old, I'll explain the structure of the class this way. Facts to Faith for me is sort of like a three-step process. You've got to understand, which is not easy on this issue, you've got to trust your enemies. Practice trusting your enemies yourself and think about what that means for people caught up in this conflict about trusting. And trusting to be, I really think, to overcome violence. I mean, there's just no way that this situation is going to go anywhere in the right direction with violence. And then you've got to do something about it. And can I say, I should have said it every time, this, in a way, it's your vacation, and this is Holden, and I hope you're having a good time, but this issue you can hardly afford, either as Americans or as Christians. Assuming most of you are Christians, and most of you are Americans, you can hardly afford not to do something about this issue, to talk to your representative, write to your newspaper, to just reject the bias that is driving Israel, the Palestinians, the region, and the United States, and possibly the world, into a clash that can easily be avoided, but that actually could come within sight if you let things go in the sort of the war on terror direction that we're in. So I think it's really quite serious to think of what you could do. It can be in your little circle, in a bigger circle, whatever level God calls you to. In that light, I wanted to be sure I've been putting websites up here in the last couple of days, and I just wanted to focus on with the understanding. How do you understand war? Read some different newspapers. You know, read Haaretz, an English language Israeli newspaper. It's on the web, it's in English, it has an English version, Haaretz.com, www in front of all of these, of course, or some websites don't even have that anymore, I think. But The Guardian from Manchester in England, left wing, but God help you, you've got so much right wing propaganda on this issue, you need to have some left wing propaganda to balance it out. Equal time, okay, remember the old equal time rule back when American media were worth watching? Well, read The Guardian. Also very left-wing, but you'll read stuff here you never see, the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. Yes?
Isn't that Guardian website, guardian.co.uk?
You're right. Sorry. So, you know, America stole the .com. Other countries have to put their names in there. Guardian.co.uk. Washington-report, I think it's .org. Washington Report on Middle East Affairs.
Pretty. It's an acronym level. I think it's WR.
No, this gets it.
They can Google it. Yeah,
you can Google it. Pretty radical, but again, somebody should make a study. Is it half as bad as what we're all given, as if that's truth? Foundation for Middle East Peace, established by a former diplomat, U.S. diplomat. Solid studies of what the settlement issue amounts to. FMEP, CMEP, Churches for Middle East Peace. The ELCA, if you're ELCA, if you're a member of this, a group of 25 denominations with an office in Washington that patiently lobby that other piece of occupied territory, Capitol Hill, to keep thinking of some other things. I have in front of me just a couple of resources. Somebody wanted to get the data on this book. Are you here, sir? Okay. This is interesting. We had a privilege to meet with the Negotiations Affairs Department of the PLO in April. And this is just after Hamas had been elected. And they had this brochure of stuff, just absolutely excellent stuff. And I think there's some of you who probably think this, you know, this should be burned. Because the PLO, doesn't it still have a residue in our mind as a kind of a terrorist organization?
Or that they're not very smart. And look how beautiful that is.
Yeah. But here's the maps. Here's the articles. It's just an amazing resource. But stuff like this is just begging for readers. It's just begging for readers. And this is the PLO. Are you brave enough to take it in your hands? PLO, just feel the end of the session, I passed around, and the early birds might have gotten all the worms, but I passed around two pieces of paper, which is an example of how at the World Council of Churches, we try to do what we can do, and I'm paid to do this. You're probably not going to be paid to do it, but I hope I'm doing it with the same spirit you might have. Two examples of policy statements. One actually passed by the executive committee of the WCC, which makes it almost like the Ten Commandments for you. No, that's a joke. but we passed this before the recent troubles, but after the Hamas election. The time is ripe to do what's right. And if possible, I'd like to read a little bit of that with you towards the end of the session. But to get into what we have here today, I'll go back to the plan for the week. And whether you were here or not, you know, it's all over. I hope you understand. Whether you're here or not, it's all over. I hope you realize this issue about trust, making peace in the heart of any kind of violence, any kind of conflict, but no more, nothing more so than this conflict. Possibly the longest running conflict in the world right now, unresolved conflict or crisis in the world. So then the third step is don't leave it there. Be a doer. Be a doer of justice. So I call this session Doers of Justice. And I want to tell you about three or four who are examples from Israel, from Palestine, and from outsiders. We could sure use, I joked yesterday that at the WCC we're trying to clone Nelson Mandela before he dies, you know, because we could use him in the Middle East. Or Bishop Tutu. That's a joke also. But there are plenty of smaller heroes around, probably just as solid, very tenacious, very understanding, very trustworthy, people who we can look up to as leaders on this issue of making peace in Israel-Palestine, seeking peace. People, when it's all said and done, who do for others as they would have others do for them. You know, back to those basic ideas to break out of this kind of hopelessness that we feel about this. So today we're going to nominate three of them for the Holden Peace Prize right here as we go to this third step of the journey from facts to faith. And the most inspiring ones for me are the Israelis who risk isolation, stigmatization, ostracism, violent language, all kinds of things in order to be advocates for peace. And they may be religious. If they are, they're Jewish. They may not be religious, but it's an amazing thing, and I think a humbling word from our God to all of us is that believers have no corner on the business of peacemaking. I don't think God just reserves that for people that believe in God. I think God has given that as a gift to all kinds of people, and it's humbling to stand there side by side with somebody who is totally different from you, but if you had to go to the pearly gates, probably get in line a lot quicker than you did. Even though you're a serious Christian like me. My first on my list is a Jewish guy named Jeff Halper. Some of you know him. His website is here, ICAHD.org, ICAD they call it, Israeli Committee Against House Demolition. He's a hero, I think, a doer of justice, because most of what the world sees is a tit-for-tat violence between armed actors on both sides. Just a tit-for-tat, endless cycle. You did it, this kind of ridiculous thing. He saw that the real potency of the occupation is hidden, kind of like an iceberg. I talked about the psychological dimension yesterday as the iceberg that we can't hardly see, but is really driving things. There's more to that iceberg than just psychology. Halper is an anthropologist, and if I can be excused to use a triple mixed metaphor to describe what his work is, he does ultrasounds, he does CAT scans, he takes satellite pictures of that iceberg. And he lays out what you cannot see without the work and the brains of a person like him. He talks about a hidden structure to the occupation which he calls a matrix of control. A matrix of control. And he discovered that structure because he made a common sense, courageous commitment to take care of a very obvious problem, the fact that although collective punishment is illegal under the Geneva Convention when you occupy somebody else's land, you can't punish the people for whatever they do back to you. You have to punish the people who do it back to you, right? You can't punish them. But what happens all the time is, suicide bomber, bring the bulldozers, his house is toast. And his family is homeless. or her family is homeless. Throwing stones, maybe. Bulldoze the houses where the stone throwers hide behind. There are many, many cases where well over 2,000 Palestinian families have lost their homes as an example of collective punishment. So ICAD, with Jeff Halpern and his staff in this little NGO, they protest that. They help to rebuild homes, sometimes several times because they keep getting pushed down. They do everything around that. But that wasn't enough because he understood that what was really happening was the people who lose their homes have broken the rules of the matrix. And if you break the rules, you lose your home. So what is the matrix? And here's a description of it. The matrix of control is designed to allow Israel to control every aspect of Palestinian life in the occupied territories while lowering Israel's military profile in order to give the impression to the outside world that what Palestinians refer to as an occupation is merely proper administration. And if you've heard Israeli authorities, they refer to it as the administered territories. They don't refer to it as the occupied territories. And that Israel has a duty to defend itself and the status quo. The status quo is occupation, subjugation, stealing of people's land, putting your own people on it in the place. You've got to defend that. And that's their right, their duty to protect themselves. Our president says it by the day during this present crisis. Halper's group details a web of zones, restrictions, and intrusions. Occupied land, for example, is divided into areas A, B, C, D, H1, H2, yellow, green, blue, and white. All of those are different kinds of categories. If you look at the occupation maps, they all have ways to show what this is. Controlled by a mixture of civil administrators, military orders, and undercover agents. Underground water is controlled. Businesses have to cope with various licenses and inspections. Farmers cannot plant or sell certain crops. Palestinians cannot work, travel, or enter other areas without permits from Israeli authorities. Some of this isn't working anymore because the violence and the end run that is happening now, where the map I showed you 2 days ago shows Palestine in 2007, if they can get away with it and if Bush continues to allow them to get away with it. They don't even need this anymore because they're boiling it down to a smaller and smaller area that will then become a kind of a Palestinian. They'll say, that's another country. We're not involved there. The part that they leave, which will be about 10% of historic Palestine. They're well on their way to doing that with the wall and the other policies. Halper's not a lonely voice with this. Others join him. And he has a window on his website where he keeps the number of refuseniks, the ones Jennifer referred to, Israeli officers and men from the military who refused to serve in the occupied territories. And it's up in the thousands, has been in the past. You also, if you watch the crisis, you notice other voices from within Israel. And Israel is blessed with a free press and with a lot of people that have a good opinion to share. And nothing less than four of the past heads of Israel's security service, the Shin Bet. Have you heard of Shin Bet? Kind of like the CIA and the FBI and some other things rolled up into one. The shadowy enforcers of the harshest aspects of the occupation. The four directors who ran the Shin Bet from 1980 to 2000 went public at the end of 2003 when this current intifada was turning into a horrible spectacle of violence on both sides. They gave an interview to the largest newspaper in Israel, Yediot Aharonot. I can't say it very well, Aharonot. And here's a little bit of a quote from some of them. The Israeli government's actions and policies during the three-year-old Palestinian uprising have gravely damaged Israel and its people. One of them, Avraham Shalom, said, "We must once and for all admit that there is another side, that it has feelings, and that it is suffering, and that we are behaving disgracefully. We have turned into a people of petty fighters using the wrong tools." You can read that in the Israeli press with some regularity, with some regularity. In a comment that is also relevant to us and to the war on terror, one of the other directors of Shin Bet, Carmi Gilon, argued that Israel's political agenda has become solely a security agenda. It only deals with the question of how to prevent the next terror attack, not the question of how it is at all possible to pull ourselves out of the mess that we are in today. I spoke yesterday about Jenin, where the refugee camp part of the town of Jenin was reduced to rubble in the violence of 2002, a big reprisal for the second Intifada. And right after that, a former attorney general of Israel, Michael Ben-Yair, described the matrix that Halper has identified in historical and legal terms. This is a former attorney general. In a fairly radical metaphor, he calls the whole of the occupation the seventh day of the Six-Day War. The seventh day of the Six-Day War. Remember the Six-Day War in 1967? It's a heroic military. Do we like to worship successful wars? This is one of the prime examples. You know, in 6 days, this little tiny country kicked the posteriors of all the surrounding nations and grabbed a whole bunch of land and Moshe Dayan and all that. Well, here's Ben-Yair. The seventh day, ever since then, we enthusiastically chose to become a colonial society, ignoring international treaties, expropriating land, transferring settlers from Israel to the occupied territories, engaging in theft, and finding justification for all these activities. Passionately desiring to keep the occupied territories, we developed two judicial systems, one progressive and liberal in Israel, the other cruel and injurious in the occupied territories. In effect, we established an apartheid regime in the occupied territories immediately following their capture, and that regime exists to this day. Halper, if you like, keeps the police records of that seventh day. The police records, exhibit A being how many innocent parties get their house bulldozed as a form of reprisal for another deed, which was really a form of resistance. And I've mentioned suicide bombing a couple times. You really have to stop and think about suicide bombing when you go to a place like Palestine, because it's not adequate to say these are animals, these are devils, these are subhuman beings who do that. It is not adequate or helpful to come to terms with what's happening there, if that's how we describe them. And I mention it again because typically then your family pays grievously for what you did, and they didn't know you were going to do it in most cases. Look at his website. Go there as often as you can. Work for him. I think some of you folks have done that in this country. Work for Jeff Halper. Did you get his name? Jeff?
And you can join an international work camp. Look, there's a three-week one happening right now, and a member of our congregation is over there.
I tried to talk to him about my faith, and it was pretty clear that he didn't have much to talk about with me, you know, that one. As an example, I don't know what he is. I think he's a secular person.
His father was a rabbi.
Was he? Okay.
And he's a professor of anthropology.
Yeah, he's an anthropologist. Okay, another hero, this one Palestinian, is, some of us are Lutherans. Let's just call us all Christians or interested or willing to be here. Mitri Rahab, he's the pastor of Evangelical Lutheran Christmas Church in Bethlehem. How could you have a church in Bethlehem without calling it the Christmas Church? Well, that's Mitri Rahab. And this is, I think, one of his earlier books, I Am a Palestinian Christian, well worth reading. Don't think that because a book is 5 or 7 or 10 years old or 15 years old that it doesn't have anything to tell you. What it'll tell you is nothing has changed. It's only gotten worse. And then you see things that can't happen anymore because they've all been done. All the dirty deeds have been done in some parts of the land, and you get to read about the people who got the short end of the stick. Mitri, M-I-T-R-I, I'll put it on the board, R-A-H-E-B. Mitri Rahab. We named our dog after him, but don't tell him that because dogs are not honored in the Middle East. But our dog is a very honorable person, so it's really a tribute to Mitri. Yeah, that one's in the bookshop. And these are both out of the library, okay? Mitri, just briefly, while Jenin was being smashed, the part I reported on yesterday, I called it, you know, like ground zero, he and his parishioners were spending half a year trapped in their houses under curfew in Bethlehem. as part of this reprisal against terror. You know, anything goes when you're reprisal against terror. But that didn't stop him from keeping on with his various projects, which I would call pillars of hope, ways of building up his community and building a future for his community in a kind of a Martin Luther sense, plant that apple tree even though the world is ending. He has that, his work has that flavor to it. Now, we've got to ask ourselves, is Bethlehem, which is still half Christian, why is it only half Christian when it used to be more Christian, like majority Christian? Because Christian Palestinians emigrate from this hellhole 3 times faster than Muslim Palestinians, and that's been going on for decades. They used to be 10% of the Palestinian population. Today, they're 2% or 1.5%. Nobody really wants to count. And if that finishes up now, the last 1.5% trickles away, then yours and my connection to this conflict, the Western world's connection to this conflict, is radically changed, because then all the Palestinians are Muslims, because the Christians are all in Detroit or Los Angeles. And then we've lost the connection, which the Christian Palestinians will tell you almost to a person, that is far more about their rights as people in that land than anything to do with religion, Christianity, or Islam. This is not a Jewish-Muslim war. It's not a Jewish versus Christian-Muslim war. It's a war about land. It's a war about who gets to have this, what some people have called this much-promised land. So when we lose them, which is also part of the strategy, I think, make the Christians emigrate, and it snowballs, because once you have your uncle here, or your cousin, or your wife, or your son, then you can get the green card yourself, and they bring them over. And a lot of them are living in both places, trying to hang on. But if you're a young person, you know,
no jobs,
you can't move, you can't marry. If you loved somebody in the West Bank, you couldn't go to see her because of the travel. So there's every reason to leave. And seeing the Christians go is also an interesting dynamic for the Muslims to be watching. So it's whose side are they on? Are the Christians on the Jewish side? You know, of course they're not. The Palestinian Christians and some of us. We want to be fair. But the dynamic is there. So is Bethlehem now only half Christian? Is it too holy, too famous to destroy it, like as if it was a Muslim ghetto or a nest of terrorists? I'm not sure. I really am not sure. What happened to Jenin could happen to Bethlehem. When you go with an Israeli guided tour, and or you hang out with some evangelical Christians or fundamentalist Christians who are there, they'll talk about, yeah, we went into that terrorist. There were terrorists all around, but we went to see the Church of the Nativity. They went from Israel into Bethlehem to see the Church of the Nativity and then came out, and they were sort of happy they got out with their lives because they had to go in amongst the thieves and the bombers to do that. Once you've dehumanized people to be that, you can bomb them. You can bomb them. So it was besieged, the Holy Sepulchre was, for a horrible, horrible, I think, month and a half or 2 months in 2003. There have been plenty of violent incursions into it, and many other less violent, but I would say equally violent things. There used to be a beautiful wooded knoll, which was, you know, if Hallmark could have designed the place where Jesus should be born, they would have put that wooded knoll there, beside the shepherd's field, beside the little town of Bethlehem. And I used to admire it every time I went there. And then, guess what happened? They managed to get the land declared vacant or crown land from Jordanian town or something. There's many ways in which the land gets alienated from its local inhabitants. And today, the trees are all gone, and the whole hill has been scalped into like a ziggurat almost, and there are condominiums of settlements covering the whole hill. And it's right in the face of Bethlehem, Beit Jala, and Beit Sahur, the three Christian villages that are there together. And worse than that, the separation wall loops completely around these three communities like a python coiling itself and cutting off all chance. The tourist industry is dead. The buses come, the ones brave enough to go into this nest of terrorists. I'm joking. They come, they go to the Holy Sepulchre, they see where Jesus was born. They don't have time to go to the shops anymore because that would mean going down the side streets. They go back in the bus, go back to Israel. And the Palestinian Christians and Muslims who want to sell them an olive wood cross or a something for your Christmas decoration, the shops are closed. The few that are open are just open
because... There's no electricity anyway.
Some of that too. Anyway, this is pretty depressing stuff, but
yes.
You're here because you have a calling to deal with this issue. Mitri's response has been to build for peace. As I said, he's got a center, an international center, he calls it, where they hold cultural events, they do job training, they hold art, they do art, they do music, they do drama. There's a hostel for international visitors. You can stay there, and if you go to this area, and it's a lot safer than you think. Okay, what's on TV is not what's happening to everybody every day. Go there and stay in Palestine if you absolutely can. Don't stay. Well, stay half and half if you feel like you have to be equal on that one. But he's got a place for you to stay. They've got a media center. They have a website. This one here, BethlehemMedia.org. I think that's right. Bethlehem-Media. But this is also Mitri's website. Anadwa.org is Ann Basie here. She knows exactly. His idea with Bethlehem Media was, okay, people can't come to us. We're going to make a website where you can visit us virtually. And it's full of commentary about the occupation that you will never read in an American newspaper, or rarely, unless you send it to the editor and go talk to him and say, he ought to run this because this is the other side of the coin. You can find things like that on BethlehemMedia.org. I've called Mitri when just after an IDF, an Israeli Defense Force tank, had smashed into his house and soldiers had shot up his church, and he and his family were housebound for a month under curfew. I called him, the telephone still worked. He was strained. He was definitely tense and in a bad place, but very calm, shaken but gracious about his assailants. And his biggest topic was saying how many of his parishioners were running out of food and how some were going crazy and how he couldn't get to them. And it's really something. Again, we're so far from this, but even on the phone to somebody who's stuck in the middle of it, it comes through. It comes through the wire to you. You can hear it in their voice, what they're going to. So I encourage you to visit his website as well as Jeff's. They're two of the sort of unsung heroes, unheard champions of dignity and justice. Why are they unsung? Why are they unheard? You tell me. Why don't we know about them? Remember the Five Commandments? Early in the week, I did five ways to understand the conflict, and one of them was, you know, don't accept information which is self-serving. Ask what you're not hearing. Ask those who don't have a voice. Listen to them to balance the ones who have all the voice. These would be two of them. A third kind would be foreigners. There are a lot of people there, church and otherwise, who have given their lives in long and short periods to try to help this Holy Land to a place where it can nourish the two people who deserve to live there, and the three faiths that have no choice but to find their some credible self-expression. All three faiths are crying to come right by what's happening there in that Holy Land, where Jerusalem is holy to all three. I'd like to honor one of them as an example. It's one of us, if you're an American from our types of churches. A guy named Al Glock, he was a Missouri Synod. Anybody know what the Missouri Synod is? Missouri Synod missionary in the Holy Land for many years. And he went as a biblical scholar and as a biblical archaeologist. I think he went in the 50s. Missouri Synod, biblical archaeology, okay? What's political about that? Nothing. So he probably thought when he went. But what he began to realize was that archaeology was and is being used to strengthen the occupation. And so if you go there all hot to find out where Jesus walked, and it happens to be someplace where the intervening 2,000 years did what history does, which tends to add, what is it, about a foot for every 1,000 years? You know, you always have to dig down because people trash their homes or the home fall down and they just kind of roll them out flat and put the next one on top. So time builds up on settlements like that. And what happens is, if you're going back to the biblical archaeology, and Al began to realize that, you had to get a bulldozer and get rid of 2,000 years of other layers to get to the stuff you want to see and you want to help us understand the Bible. That's not a bad deal, is it? Not a bad thing? Well, the only problem is 13 of those 20 centuries, okay? 13 of those 20 centuries are Muslim centuries. And to scoop all that stuff up and throw it away to get at the stuff you want, the Jewish early Christians, layers,
You're throwing away the history of the people who are today being thrown away themselves. And it becomes very political to do archaeology like that. And so Al Glock, Missouri Synod pastor from Illinois, decided he could no longer be a biblical archaeologist. And he began to be an archaeologist of everyday life in Palestine in the last 400 years under the Ottoman Empire. And he went into village archaeology instead of biblical, historical, spiritual, wonderful Disneyland archaeology, okay? And worked on that and tried to not be an accomplice in the many, many ways in which different areas of life are turned into another nail in the Palestinian coffin. He went from elite archaeology to life of the people archaeology. And even became the father of Palestinian archaeology. He became the head of the Department of Archaeology at Beer Zeit University, north of Jerusalem, and was the mentor of many young Palestinian archaeologists who then had a real interest in what they could do as archaeologists, which would be to demonstrate, if anybody wants to listen, that they've been there for a while. You know, some of them 1,000 years, some of them 1,500 years, some of them 400 years, some of them 200 years, but certainly not without a great claim to also have the right to live on that land. One quiet Sunday afternoon in 1992, Al Glock at 3 o'clock was going to stop by his lab assistant's house to give her something that was going on in their archaeology lab. And between his car and her front door, walking on the path through her garden, somebody with a gun put 3 bullets into him. 67-year-old Lutheran ELCA missionary. By this time, he was no longer Missouri. I'm sure he could have been, but he wasn't. And 3 bullets in him. And we had just arrived a year or two earlier in the region, and we were privileged to be with him and with Alice, his wife, who's still Lois, his wife, who's still in New Jersey. And there's a book about it called Sacred Geography, a book about his life and his murder. Who Killed Al Glock is basically the subtitle, Sacred Geography. And it's a good read because you can't tell who killed him. Was it Palestinian radicals who were mad? Because during that second intifada right then in 1992, you had a foreigner, an American of all things, running a sensitive department in a Palestinian university. And so radicals would say, we got to get rid of this man. You can argue that. Or was it a hitman for the people who disapproved of one of his projects, which was to edit the text of a book called All That Remains? And the book about All That Remains was the book that had gone with people like him to find the sites where 600 villages were razed. You know, razed means wiped out in 1948. The map in there. Well, they tried to document the sites, gather old photos, talk to survivors, and put together some kind of a record of this chapter of establishing a new country on the back of one that was already there without getting rid of the first one. And Al read the galleys of this book, and they were faxed to him at a United Nations fax, which was not secure. And there's a motive, if you like. Who didn't want that book to come out? It's a possibility, but you can't say. Nobody can say yet. You read the book and see what you think, who killed him. Fortunately, murder mysteries about missionaries are pretty rare, and even though this one might never be solved, it's still an eye-opener about the kind of lawlessness that breeds itself under occupation and oppression and has only gotten a lot worse since he was killed. A last example is a Christian Palestinian, but this time from one of the older churches, the original churches, if you like, a Greek Catholic. Greek Catholics are Greek Orthodox, and Greek Orthodox can basically claim to be the original Christians, I think it's fair to say. You know, they're on the spot where it all started, they're still there, they're going to be there no matter what happens. But some of them decided that maybe Rome was really the center of it now, and so they became Catholic but didn't change anything else. They're called Greek Catholics. So they recognize the Pope, but they've kept their Orthodox liturgy. In some cases, they still use Aramaic in the liturgy, Jesus' language in the liturgy. And this guy, Emil Shufani from Nazareth, a Greek Catholic priest, he decided that his first step to peace would be to touch the suffering, the memory of that unimaginable horror, the Nazi Holocaust, that plays such a role in that iceberg of psychological factors driving Israel into where it is and where it's going in such a destructive way. So he set out to demonstrate solidarity with that experience as a Palestinian and as a Christian, without demanding Jewish solidarity with the oppression and the suffering of the Palestinian people in the occupied territories as a sort of a quid pro quo. Sound a little unconditional, a little godlike, you know, a little Holy Spirit influenced. So what did Emil do? He and his a journalist named Nazir Majli, who I think is a Muslim, I'm not sure about that. Nazareth has a Palestinian population who are Israeli Palestinians. There's about a million, I think. Is it a million? Israeli citizens who are Palestinians. They didn't flee. They weren't chased out. They're citizens within Israel in places, especially like Nazareth, Galilee. He and Israelis and other Palestinians made up a Jewish Muslim delegation, Jewish Muslim Christian delegation, to Auschwitz. And Nazir, his colleague, was asked, why are you going to Auschwitz when Israel's killing our children in Jenin? It was at the same time as Jenin. And Nazir replied, I tell people that we mustn't let ourselves be prisoners of the existing modes of thinking and that we shouldn't be fettered to outmoded concepts. Yes, we are trying to turn things inside out, which is good, because the present situation and all the hatred that exists will destroy both people. We know we'll get clobbered by critics and perhaps even pay a heavy personal price, but the hope for a better future in this region is worth much more than that. We're living in hell, and we want to breathe a little clean air to be more pure. I'm out to cleanse myself and my people of the hatred that exists today. And that's a quote from a story about him in Haaretz, the website I gave you there. I think doers like this help to show the importance of cleansing our hearts from violence, from hate, seeking understanding, trying to build trust, risking love for others, and coming to the place where the tough issues can be brought up and heard, even though the dangers and the difficulties will always exist. So three people who in my mind, and there are many others, but they're largely unknown to you, but perhaps that's a way to get into this, is to try to make it your business to try to get to know through books, through articles, perhaps by visiting, get to know some of the people who are standing for what's right in this circumstance. This will be a first. How about some questions and discussion? Yeah.
I'd like to know about the young American woman that got killed. Israeli volunteer.
Yeah. A young American, Rachel Corey. 3 years ago, 4 years ago?
2003.
Yeah. She was with a group called ISM. You can go to their website too. ISM, International Solidarity Movement. And that's a secular group. I don't know what her motivation was, but.
Evergreen student.
Evergreen?
Evergreen State College is, they're quite knowledgeable about world affairs.
Okay.
She had a Jewish professor also who helped her become more aware of the situation.
Well, I'd like to mention three organizations because there's a sort of a range and there's actually more than that. But ISM is International Solidarity Movement. I don't know enough about them to give you a big pitch or otherwise. But Rachel was standing on the rubble of a destroyed home, I believe. No? What was she standing on?
She was with a team of ISM volunteers, and an eyewitness who was there, Joe Carr, actually showed the pictures he took there and did a poem, basically like a rap, at a conference I was at to explain what had happened. What the team does is they go in as a team, and they were trying to protect this last home in the strip along between Egypt and Rafah that Israel has continued to, what Palestinians call shave, so that they keep holdos in the houses. The pharmacist's house was the last one, the Nasrallah family. And the Nasrallahs were determined not to leave the house. So the family was staying there, so Rachel would stay with the family, but also as the bulldozers would approach, a team of the ISM volunteers went out to stand in their orange flak jackets. sense that the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, with their militarized caterpillar bulldozer, do not want to bulldoze, they always thought, an American citizen.
Right.
And they had been successful in keeping the house from being bulldozed for a period of time, and on this particular day, that wasn't the case. The bulldozer continued to go up, and as the turning of the soil, the sandy soil, rolled up, she kind of got sucked under, and the bulldozer lowered, or the soldier in the bulldozer,
blade.
Lowered the blade and scraped it over her back and up.
Mm-hmm.
And so the volunteer's feather out her back initially was broken. She spoke momentarily and she died.
Mm-hmm.
And that a resolution to investigate her death is in Congress. It got about 30 signatures and it sort of stalled and hasn't gone any further. And the family's very much working in the targeting the Caterpillar Corporation, trying to stop their supplying of these bulldozers ready for arming or protective shields through the through their efforts. And there's a national coalition with Stop Caterpillar that you could check with. It's called U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation.
Yeah.
And Harper's Magazine published her letters to her parents about 2 years ago. I've never read anything with such a clear voice, for just a clear understanding of the situation and a hopeful voice.
Yeah.
And you can read her letters by going to the RachelCorryFoundation.org, which is based in Olympia.
Corey is C-O-R-I-E?
C-O-R-R-I-E.
Yeah. Okay. The other two I put up here, that was one example of what ISM does. PCT, Christian Peacemakers Team, CPT. CPT, Christian Peacemakers, peacemakerteams.org, I think, CPT.org. They are a Christian group that does similar things. You might want to think about supporting them, joining them. And then there's another one that I get to plug because it's run by the World Council of Churches, and it's the best. It's the Ecumenical Accompaniment Program in Palestine and Israel, EAPPI. I wasn't there when they named it. I wouldn't have let them name it so clumsily. But it's named, and it has its own identity, and it does boil down to EAs. They talk about ecumenical accompaniment. And this is cool because mission theology these days, talk to Ann Basie, who's here from the ELCA, in some of our churches, is really studying this word of accompaniment. And the idea is go and support through a ministry of presence, through a ministry of solidarity, and through a ministry of advocacy. Three things. People living affected by the occupation, be they Palestinian or Israeli. And there are six sites, and people do very mundane jobs. But the good thing is, some of them are 75 years old, the EAs, the Ecumenical Accompaniers. And some of them are, you have to be 21. 21 to however old you can still walk. And my favorite example is two grandmothers. I mentioned them the other day. They tend to be grandmothers. Who walk Palestinian children to a little school that's trying to stay open in the middle of Hebron. And when the grandmothers are there, the teenage settler girls who specialize in spitting and kicking and throwing little stones at the children do it less than they would otherwise. So if you want to do that for 3 months, see me after this session. And you have to find some support, but it'll change your life. And when you come home, you need to talk about it. You need to write your congressman. You need to carry on and bring the story back. We have about 25 people there at any time. We've done about 200 people so far from 12 countries. Swedes, Norwegians, Danes, British, German, Finns, South Africans, and Kenyans through the World Council of Churches. Other questions or comments? Yeah.
Is the Christian Brothers College still open, still going in Bethlehem?
Yeah, I think it is. I haven't been there for a while, but I think
there's
so.
There's a brother in Latechi.
Uh-huh.
You ever hear that name?
Can't. I think I lost the file. But, you know, you're hearing about a few people from me. You could have 100 speakers who would tell you three other people who would be in a similar thing. Yeah. It's a bigger place than you think, even though it's a real small place. A lot of people are working on this. Yeah.
Jonathan, if this is appropriate, I would like to hear a little bit about more specifically what you do and how you got into this kind of work.
Thank you for asking that question, as we planned right now. No, that was a genuine question. I handed out two things, which I will try to kill two birds with one stone by answering the question by way of a practical example that might be of some use. This is a tricky, tricky area to work in. And so what, as all political things are, okay? So the church, the World Council of Churches, since it was formed, and I have here every policy statement of the World Council of Churches on this conflict in Israel-Palestine. Okay, these are all passed by the governing bodies of the Central Committee at the highest level, the Executive Committee, and in extreme cases, the General Secretary can make policy himself when he has to. But generally, it has to be the governing bodies, the people elected from the 438 member churches in 150 countries, including most of your churches if you're the U.S. Protestants, you're members of the WCC. And altogether, the churches behind this, if they only knew it and could get their act together, are 600 million people. There's China, and then there's the WCC. Did you realize that? You know? Of course, this is a sort of a joke. I'm feeling funny today. most people in the WCC don't know they're part of it. But again, if we could, if 1% of us could get together on this issue, we could change the course of this conflict. Because it's hungry for a word of wisdom and of love and of compassion and of fairness. This is wisdom, love, compassion, and fairness. I gave you two examples. What do? I write this stuff. Let me also say as an aside, I have been a little freer than I am on the job with what I've told you. You can't talk like I've talked here and expect to get very far if you're talking to the Israeli government. You have to figure out what you want to say. These are examples. We would put this in front of an Israeli member of the Knesset and try to go over with her from time to time, or with an ambassador. We meet the Israeli ambassador in Geneva, and we say, this is, he already has it, but we give him a copy anyway. That's part of my job, to continue with the aid of colleagues and the critique of our commission members, who are wonderful people. You write a draft, you send it out, they tear it to pieces, you throw out your wilder ideas, and you end up with some of this stuff like this. That's a good part of it. Then you go to meetings, you try to set up meetings, you may put delegations together. I have a colleague who runs the CAPPI program, which is in a sense asking citizens, Christian citizens from these countries, to become ambassadors themselves, ambassadors for peace, signs of international solidarity, living presence under occupation. I think the real pay dirt is in trying to mobilize mobilizers. So from Geneva, you can't do hardly anything directly with people like you, because you just die under the thousands of requests. It's not like, you know, one hub and many spokes and that's it. But what it really could and is and should be, I think, churches that are taking this seriously have their own advocacy networks and mission departments. Whatever, whoever's doing it, church and society groups, and they have a network, and God bless them if the parishes who could take part in that would only join those networks, or form their own networks, or join Sabil. I haven't even mentioned Sabil. Naim Atik is another one of these heroes I could talk about. He's an Anglican priest in Jerusalem who has his own group called Sabil, and it's Palestinian Christian Voice for Justice, and he has a network of people working at the grassroots level. Join that. Join something that hooks you up with others, because what we need is the voice of reason, the voice of concern for both peoples, articulated by so many people that they can't ignore it. And Israel is very sensitive to what people say about it, the government of Israel. They're very sensitive to what people say about it. And you can see it when they do bad things and say, nobody said anything bad about this bad thing we did, so it must be okay. It must be. When the Rome conference last week couldn't come up with a ceasefire, the foreign minister of Israel said, hey, guess what? We can go ahead. So the absence of doing the right thing becomes an enabler of doing the wrong thing. And your voices, I kid you not, your voices, especially because our government is almost completely, what's the word? Neutered on this issue. Our government is worse than neutral. It's a We are accomplices with Israel in the occupation. Their policy is our policy. Our policy is their policy. And if we don't if you don't think that's true, I'll have a special remedial session with you after. So, I'm not going to talk about this one, but read it, because what's happening, you could say Gaza is the microcosm, you could say Bethlehem is the microcosm of the occupation, you could say Jenin is the microcosm of the where everything is present in a smaller framework. And the one we could probably get our brains around the best is Bethlehem, because everything's there. The wall, the expropriation, the settlements, the violence, the killing off of life, and the emigration of people under the burden. It's not worth living there anymore, and so go. And when they go, then great. And there is a policy of slow transfer, slow transfer. Make them leave at a rate that won't get you accused of genocide. Because the definition of genocide includes pushing a people off of their land. But do it so slow that nobody will blow the whistle on you. Jerusalem's another one. And this is really crazy, because you can't, if Israel thinks it's going to have peace by controlling Jerusalem all by itself, you can only come to that conclusion if you're completely lost in your own program. And you're willing to fight to the death to anybody who will take you on. There are 1.5 million Muslims, and I'd like to say there are 1.5 billion, and I'd like to say there ought to be 1.5 billion Christians who say, no, this isn't right. Jerusalem needs to be shared between the people that think it's holy. You can control part of it. The Palestinians, the other people who live there need to control the other part, and the whole thing needs to be an open city. Go back to the UN plan in 1947. This is about Jerusalem, where it is today. Please, please read it. This one was passed in May before the invasion of Lebanon, but after the Hamas victory. And what might be worth reading? Let me just say, I'll just read a little bit. After the beginning, failure to comply with international law and consequences thereof has pushed the situation on the ground up to the point of no return. The disparities are appalling. One side is positioning itself to unilaterally establish final borders, on territory that belongs to the other side. The other side is increasingly confined to the scattered enclaves that remain. On one side, there is control of more and more land and water. On the other side, there are more and more families deprived of land and livelihoods. On one side, as many people as possible are being housed on occupied land. On the other side, the toll mounts of refugees without homes or land. One side controls Jerusalem, a city shared by two peoples and three world religions. The other, Muslim and Christian, watches its demographic, commercial, and religious presence wither in Jerusalem. From both sides, military forces or armed groups strike across the 1967 borders, the ones that are recognized internationally by the UN, and kill innocent civilians. On both sides, authorities countenance such attacks. Finally, the side set to keep its unlawful gains is garnering support from part of the international community. This is a real important sense. They used to only have the kind of knee-jerk support of the U.S. Now, increasingly, because the U.S. has made opposition to it such a costly proposition for other countries like France and Germany and Britain, that they're caving, and they're going along with some of the wilder propositions about what's happening there, namely the idea that Hamas should be ostracized as beyond the pale. You can deal with Hamas. You can tell them straight, point blank, you want to be the government of Palestine? Okay, let's deal. Let's talk. Let's put our cards on the table. What are they doing? They're isolating the whole Palestinian people. An Israeli minister said, they're not going to starve to death, but they're going to get real skinny. They're not going to starve to death, but the Palestinians are going to get real skinny as long as they insist on having this government that they elected in a free and fair election. The first Palestinians have held the first three genuine elections in the Arab world under occupation, and we don't like who they chose. Mm-hmm. And who they chose reflects exactly the fact that their former leader, Abbas, and the PLO, who said they don't want violence anymore and tried to control some of it, couldn't control it all, maybe didn't want to control it all, but made a go, got nothing for negotiating, and were corrupt. Mm-hmm. So pick somebody who isn't corrupt, and you won't negotiate without a quid pro quo. And that's Hamas. We met with a Hamas representative elected to the Legislative Council, a young guy from Bethlehem, and asked him to tell us what their program was. Let him explain who he is. Let him say what he wants to say. And then go away and judge with you on a work with him. But that's what needs to happen. You've heard it 1,000 times. It was so critical. You don't negotiate peace with your friends. You negotiate peace with your enemies. So that's that line. The one side set to keep its unlawful gains is garnering support from the international. The side that, despairing at those unlawful gains, used legitimate elections to choose new leaders, is being isolated and punished. All parties to the conflict and the foreign powers implicated in it now face a world dangerously divided over this conflict. And if you don't think that's true, go read the New York Times hanging in there. There are provinces of Indonesia who are going against the separation of mosque and state, which has been there since the start of Indonesia, and adopting Sharia law and turning into theocratic sub-states of Indonesia. Part of the dynamic there is to react to the wildness of the American domination in the Middle East and of Israeli domination of Palestinians, seen as Jewish and Christian attacks on Muslims. If you think of the adventures we've had in the last 10 years overseas with our weapons, everybody but Serbia, we bombed Serbia, remember? During the Kosovo crisis, we bombed Serbia. Remember, we hit the Chinese embassy by mistake? Twice? Okay. Except for Serbia, every other country we've attacked has been Muslim. And if you're sensitive about your identity, if you think your religion and your identity are completely the same thing, as Islam always says, it's not a religion, it's a way of life. That sounds like a good line, doesn't it? Shouldn't we have a way of life out of our religion? Anyway, if you don't separate those two, and you keep getting hit, and you think that the ummah, you know, the Muslim world, is really one world, the way the Catholic Church would like to see at least the Catholics be one world, then these are attacks on you. And so the radicalization of Islam, this isn't happening in a vacuum. Our activity is actually providing them a lot of food for, a lot of ammunition or fertilizer for this kind of ferment. We're making extremists. I really believe we are. This is my pure opinion. You don't write it in a World Council statement, but I believe we're generating extremism by our own extreme activities, in the same way that Israel generates extremism by taking an extreme position on what they think they can have. A world increasingly divided over this conflict, a world increasingly convinced that the goal of peace for all has been traded away for gains by one side. And that's exactly how it looks when you're there. One side is just doing fine, and the other side is paying for it. At this critical juncture, the contribution of churches can be to speak from the perspective of ethics. The actions noted above and others like them cannot be justified morally, legally, or even politically. You know, politically you can justify anything because it's politics. But you can't divorce politics from ethics and morality, and I hope from the kind of faith that serves others. So here's a quote from Dr. Martin Luther King, and he wrote this from the Birmingham jail when he'd been arrested, you know, for the bus boycott and those things. Time can be used destructively and constructively. Time. And remember, this is the 39th year of the occupation. The Israelites were in the desert for 40 years. That was a long time. 40 years is a long time in the Bible. And the Palestinians are under occupation for 40 years next year. The ones, if you don't count 48, where then it becomes 58 years. But let's just take 67, since those are the borders that we want to talk about. More and more I feel that the people of ill will have used time much more effectively than have the people of goodwill. We will have to repent in this generation, not merely for the hateful words and actions of the bad people, but for the appalling silence of the good people. We must use time creatively, in the knowledge that the time is always right to do right. And it goes on with if you want to know what's in this purple book, some of them are listed here. The first one, by the way, was concern for Jewish refugees from Nazi Germany. The first refugees the WCC ever talked about were Jewish refugees from Nazi Germany. And then when Israel was established, we said, gee, this is going to be a problem. There's 400,000 Palestinians that just got kicked out of their home. Yeah, now what? So we raised the two right close to each other. And that's been the theme, although we're accused, and I have hate mail here. If I run out of things to say tomorrow, I'll bring you some of the hate mail that we get, just in case you'd like to get some shivers on your skin. But we asked different people to do different things. Let me read you the one that we said to America in this one. No, it's in another one. I've got a letter to Condoleezza Rice I might share tomorrow where we asked what the U.S. can do. But I invite you to read them and give feedback, because people like you, you came to this class, so you're automatic people that are important to hear back from. Look at the last one. We're calling, we've talked to the different governments, and then we say, wait, I sound pretty biased, right? Sort of pro-Palestinian. I hope I sound pro-justice. I hope I sound pro something that will work for both people. But a lot of people who would hear me say, that guy's just unremittingly pro-Palestinian. So here's what we said about Israel. Encourage the government of Israel to base its security on peace with its neighbors, including the equitable negotiation of final borders with those neighbors and excluding the unilateral imposition of borders on those neighbors, which is, this is what they're set to do. They're going to impose final borders on the Palestinians. And unless everybody protests, it will go ahead. It's already going ahead. The wall, which was said to be a security device, has now been openly said to be part of the final borders, and where it doesn't take enough, they'll build it out further later. And just back on Shin Bet for a second, again, thank God Israel's got freedom of expression. Shin Bet did a study on whether the wall improved the security of the Israeli people, and they said it made no difference whatsoever. And you have all been told that this wall is justified because it's there to stop the suicide bombers. That's a perfect example of say one thing and do another for another purpose. And a perfect example of how violence backfires and is misused on the one hand, but also gives the people who are guilty of probably the most violence of getting away with what they want to do. The last set of bullets go or points go for churches. Call on member churches of the WCC to share solidarity with people on both sides. First, advocate for the measures above, reflecting worldwide church concern at the conflict, the implications of the conflict in different regions, the ever more urgent need for remedial actions by the responsible authorities, and use legitimate forms of pressure to promote a just peace and to end unlawful activities by Israelis or Palestinians. Tomorrow I'm going to give you the hottest thing we did in the time I've been there, which was suggest to churches that they take a look at what the Presbyterians have done, where they've looked at morally responsible investment and decided that they cannot responsibly own shares in Caterpillar anymore. But they're not going to sell them right away. They're going to talk to Caterpillar for 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years. And if Caterpillar doesn't change, and I'll bring a picture of the bulldozers tomorrow, if Caterpillar doesn't change, is the PCUSA is going to sell their shares. Carefully, slowly, transparently. We just said, hey, you guys ought to look at this. Have you got connections to the occupation? And that's where the best hate mail came back.
I don't know if this is an appropriate comment, but we did have that come to our church, our Presbyterian church. We had someone from each side, a Jewish person, advocating against it, and then the Presbyterian advocating for that measure.
I'd like to hear more how that went. Bring it to the forum tonight. There's a forum tonight on Palestine. After Vespers, probably 8:45 or
9. John, could
yes.
I share something easy that people can do? The ELCA website that John has,
is it up there? It should be.
Yeah.
It was yesterday. ELCA.org/Middle East. You can go there and click on Peace Not Walls. And there's your synod, if you're in a member of a Lutheran church, ELCA has a communionware set from Bethlehem. And with that set, which you can request from your synod, it should be on rotation to various churches, comes a DVD that the Mennonites produced titled The Dividing Wall. So in addition to communing during your church service with that, you can have an adult ad on The Dividing Wall, and it comes with a little kind of discussion, you know, guided discussions. It's a very easy, non-threatening way for you to bring this issue to your church.
Yeah. I'm going to stop here except to say, look at the second point. Find constructive ways to address threats experienced among the Jewish people, including the nature, prevalence, and impact of racism in local, national, and international context. This is a big, big deal once you get into this with both sides. And for putting that in, you know you're doing something right if you catch flack from both sides. And to put this in, I had to argue with my Arab Christian colleagues and with people in the Middle East who are member churches, even leaders who thought this was biased, to acknowledge the pain of the Jewish people. But I think that's part of what we need to do, but not let it turn into a trick I see the next course outside here. Thank you, everybody.